Session number 8185, Major Terence Verschoyle, Part 1.
Could you tell me a little about your background before the war?
Well, my father was a tea broker in India, and I was born in India myself. We're an Irish family, the Verschoyles, and he had a small property in County Fermanagh, where I spent most of my boyhood. Subsequently, I came over to England, and I went to rugby from 1908 to 1912, and then I went on to the Imperial College of Science and Technology, which from where I went on to the war.
Had you had any military experience throughout this period?
Well, to this extent that I was joined the OTC, the London University OTC, as soon as I went there in 1912. I was in a sapper unit. I think it's the only sapper unit that any OTC had, actually. And I was with them until the outbreak of war.
What sort of training did you used to do with the OTC?
Well, we used to have a drill once a week, and then of course we had an annual camp, two annual camps, I think. I can't remember whether we had two or one, either down at Aldershot in that neighbourhood. In fact, we were actually in camp when war broke out.
Can you remember anything about these camps?
Well, it was rather an unfortunate camp because, as I said, we were a sapper unit, and there was a demonstration of demolitions nearly on our last day there, and there was a premature explosion. One of our sergeant cadets got very badly injured, and in fact died a day or two later. And of course, we had to make arrangements for his funeral, and I found myself in the somewhat invidious position of being corporal of the firing party. And I remember we had a very long march with reversed arms from Cambridge Hospital to the church, which was some distance away, I don't remember how much. And that was only about 3 days before camp broke up and war started.
What were you doing when war actually broke out? Can you remember how you felt?
Well, I'd, as I say, camp had just broken back. I'd gone back over to Ireland, and my only recollection really of that immediate period is of trains full of reservists going off to their various depots.
Did you feel excited by the prospect of war? Did you think it would involve you?
I suppose I did. It'd be rather funny if I didn't.
Had you been expecting war with Germany?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
So, what did you immediately do on the outbreak of war?
Well, I applied for a commission once in the engineers, and as that hung fire for some time, I eventually was offered a commission in my own county regiment, the Skinny Fusiliers, which I very gladly accepted.
So you took that it was automatic that you would join in the
Oh
fighting.
yes.
Was there any reason, patriotism, or just because everyone was doing it? Can you
I
remember?
suppose because everybody was doing it seems a very good answer.
How did your family react?
Well, they naturally accepted it.
Was there any special procedure that you had to go through on being commissioned?
No, nothing.
No
No,
examinations
no,
or.
no, no. Oh no, they were only too glad to sweep in everybody they could then.
Why, what was your, did you have an attitude or opinion about people who didn't join up
No, I don't suppose I ever gave them a thought.
So you were given a commission in the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers. What was the next thing that happened to you? Where were you posted to?
Well, I joined them, I think, on the 30th of September, if I remember rightly, in Dublin. The battalion had actually formed at Omagh, but it had moved to Dublin, where it was continuing to form because we still had a lot of chaps to come in. And as I say, I joined them on the 30th of September 1914.
Which battalion was this?
That was the 5th Service Battalion.
What sort of quality of men were joining?
Well, they were a proper mixture. There was, I suppose, about half the battalion was Irish. Then we had a contingent of Scottish miners came over, all brought over by one remarkable man, who collected the, acted as a sort of recruiting sergeant and brought all his pals over with him, and there were about 100 of them, I think. And then we made up with a batch of unfortunate recruits who thought they were going into the DCLI and found themselves being swept into the Inniskillings instead. So they were very good lot, as a matter of fact. They very soon settled down and became skins like everybody else.
How did you react yourself to army life, the lack of privacy, the sort of discipline in lifestyle?
Well, I mean, it wasn't new to me. I'd been in OTC after all, so that I had a pretty good idea of what it was like.
It was pretty much as you expected.
Oh, yes.
Did you find that your OTC training, which after all was in the sapper side, had it adequately prepared you for your role as an officer?
Well, I had, of course, joining an infantry regiment, the sapper training wasn't particularly appetite. But otherwise, of course, training had been quite good, I think.
So you were able to give the drill commands and...
Well, I had to acquire them jolly quickly. At that time, you see, the new battalion formation of four companies instead of the eight companies which had previously been in existence up, I can't remember when, but only a year or two before war broke out, the new organisation was formed, and we had curious results of that. We had a Indian Army major among our dugouts who took drill parades by walking up and down with the book held in front of his nose and not giving orders in a commanding voice at all, but just simply reading out from the book what everybody should do. It was really rather peculiar.
You mentioned these dugouts. What sort of officer were the dugouts? Were they effective?
One or two were extremely good. My own company commander in particular, he was an admirable man. But the CO, although he'd only recently retired, I didn't think was up to very much. And one or two of the other senior officers, especially the second commander, were also very much dug out.
How did they treat you, these dug out old regulars?
Oh, just like anybody else. I mean, there were no differentiations to whether you were a regular commission or temporary.
So you followed you had the same mess. There wasn't separate messing.
Oh, yes.
Can you remember anything about the mess customs that were established in these early months? Or
no, I don't think we had any customs. We had no time for that.
You don't remember any of the sort of prohibitions talking? Were you allowed to talk about shop and things like that in the mess?
I really wouldn't like to say at this stage. I'm pretty sure we were. I don't think there was any great taboo on that sort of thing.
Were you issued with a uniform, or did you supply yourself?
Provide your own.
When did the troops get their uniforms and equipment? Was there any delay?
Well, a long delay. They were in civvies for quite a time, and even when they got their uniform, they still hadn't got greatcoats. They were in civic greatcoats for months. It took them a very long time before they were fully equipped, and of course at the start they were also without rifles, which is another important item missing.
Where were you, the officers, accommodated?
Richmond Barracks. It was a large barracks, held two battalions.
So both troops and officers were in barracks. What was the condition of these barracks?
Oh, pretty good.
I'd like to look at the training that you and the battalion went through. Just running through them one by one. Basic drill. How soon did you and the battalion and your troops become proficient at basic drill?
Well, individual training, it would be difficult to say. I suppose probably by the end of the year they were pretty good. And then platoon training, of course, followed. Company training. And we got up to a little battalion training by the time we left Dublin in April.
Could you describe the difference between each level, individual, platoon, company and battalion training? What sort of different
things? Well, I should have thought the terms themselves describe the difference between them. After all, it's a question of either acting as an individual or acting in a cohesive body. But training in those days was really, when one looks back, was very rudimentary compared with the training one got in the last war.
You went on regular route marches?
Oh, yes. We were very good at route marching, I must say. We used to do 20-mile marches quite happily.
No dropouts?
Very, very, very few. Very rare.
How about actual small arms practice, rifle practice?
Oh, yes. There was a range outside Dublin, Dollymount, where we did our musketry courses. Shooting was pretty poor. shooting all through the war was very poor, I considered. It was extraordinarily difficult to get a really high standard of musketry established. I don't know why, but it was.
Nothing. Was it perhaps anything to do with the officer's the officer concerned training, or was it just that?
I don't know. It'd be difficult to put a finger on what the cause was. All I could say was the shooting, by and large, was poor.
Did you yourself practice with a rifle or with a revolver?
Both.
What was your own personal level?
I had a splendid 4-5 revolver with a long barrel. It was really a sort of target pistol. It was the only thing I could get hold of at the time. It was a very good weapon.
Tactical exercises, actual practicing advances on enemy, that sort of thing. What sort of thing did you do in this field?
Well, in those days the attack was based on advancing by alternate rushes, that is to say one lot lay down and fired and covered the advance of the next lot. And making use of ground cover and so on, it was hardly known. It was extraordinary looking back how very rudimentary tactical training was.
So did you know at the time, did you feel at the time that the tactics you were training in were adequate?
I think we thought they were adequate. We knew no better.
So did you have any sort of training in special skills that you might need? Did you train, for instance, to be a transport officer or a machine gun officer or a bombing officer?
Well, of course, I went on courses ultimately throughout the war. Gas courses, machine gun courses, Lewis gun courses, grenade courses. One went on all these at one time or another. Not before we went out, when we were overseas.
Looking at the training overall, you've already mentioned, did you feel that the training was adequate and that the battalion was an effective fighting force when the training had...
I think we did. In that we were mistaken, because we'd done absolutely no night training at all. And of course that was, one realised later on what a fearful gap that was.
Had you done any training in trench type conditions?
No, not really.
No practice in digging trenches or anything?
Oh, well, yes, but nothing much about trench fighting or anything like that.
So, did you spend all your training at Dublin, or did you move to England?
Oh, no, we moved to England in April 15. We moved over to Basingstoke then, and camped just outside Basingstoke. During which time we did a bit of brigade training and divisional training.
Were you very conscious of being a member of a larger unit, a brigade and a division, or did you very much feel that your battalion was where your world centred?
I think really brigade and division didn't mean a great deal to us. We had a very good brigadier. We weren't so sure about our division.
In both Ireland and England, what was the relationship like between you and your troops and the civilians?
There was never any trouble.
Did they do any sort of demonstrations of affection or when you left?
We left Dublin, there were too many demonstrations of affection, because the troops were followed down to the docks by a horde of people pressing drinks upon them the whole way. It was very difficult to arrive with a sober platoon.
There's nothing you could do to stop this.
No.
Within the actual battalion, after your training, what was your relationship as a young officer like with the troops and NCOs in your platoon? How did you get on with them?
Oh, very well indeed.
What sort of relationship did you have with them? Did you
How do you mean?
Did you talk to them as a friend, or were you separate?
Oh yes, no. Irish regiments have got a much better tradition of palliness than English regiments have. I think they've always been well known for that.
So you weren't separate from
all one large family.
When did you first realise you were being posted overseas?
Very difficult to say. There are a lot of camp rumours about us, there always are. I suppose during the last month, so I shouldn't think more than a month before we actually went, there were rumours about it. And then, of course, the next thing was issue of Tropical Kit, which confirmed the rumours, and then we were off.
These rumours had been that you were going to the Dardanelles and Gallipoli, had they?
Not at first, just as we were off, we were going overseas.
When did you actually find you were going to Gallipoli?
Well, I think when the Tropical Kit was issued.
What did you heard about Gallipoli? Had you heard anything about the fighting there?
I suppose we must have heard a certain amount, but very little, because there wasn't much information given out in those days. And one knew that the landings had been a failure, but that's about all.
So you didn't really know what sort of conditions to expect when you got out there?
Not really, no.
You were issued with Tropical Kit. Was there any other special equipment, any special equipment issued?
No.
And was the Tropical Kit just standard issue?
Yes.
Khaki, yeah. Drill. The pith helmet?
Yes.
Did you buy any special equipment yourself to make things easier?
Well, I suppose I provided myself my own. I mean, officers would be expected to provide themselves their own Tropical Kit.
When did you actually leave for Gallipoli? Can you remember?
On July the 10th, 1915, from Basingstoke. I remember the march down out of camp at about 4 in the morning, a lovely summer's morning, absolutely cloudless sky. And I still remember that march down to the station. And then we went from there to Devonport, where we embarked.
Can you remember what troop ships you and your men
were? Well, the battalion was split. The battalion as a whole, with a certain number of officers, went on a very, wasn't much better than a cattle boat called the Novian. The rest of the officers, I forget how many now, but I think the majority of the officers really came on the Elonia, Cunada, where we were fed absolutely like fighting cocks. I've never had such meals in my life. And had a marvellous time, because apart from being officer of the watch from time to time, one had no duties at all, because one hadn't any troops under one's control. So that was all very pleasant.
Did you suffer from seasickness at
no.
all? Were you aware of any submarine or surface radar
no.
threat? You would. Where did you stop en route?
We called in at Malta, just to coal, I think. And then we went on to Alexandria. And then from Alexandria, after a bit of a wait, we went up to the island of Mytilene, or Lesvos, whichever you like to call it.
Mytilene. Do you have any strong impressions of the journey, or any recollections?
Well, except that I say it was an extremely pleasant overture to a campaign.
Could you describe Mytilene Island when you
arrived? Mytilene is one of the most beautiful of the Greek islands. Very well wooded, unlike some of the islands, which of course are very, very bare indeed. And we were in a landlocked harbour, marvellous harbour, along with two or three other transports, and a guard ship of the Canopus, which had been in the Falkland Islands. As I say, it was a lovely island. One got quite a nice lot of bathing at the start, but needless to say, after we'd been there about a week or so, the water was getting pretty, pretty foul, as you can imagine. So the bathing wasn't quite so good. But one used to go out for sails in the boats. There's nothing to do, you see. We didn't land at all. All the troops could do was a bit of PT every day on board. Again, until the battalion came, joined us a bit later after we'd arrived. As I say, we had nothing to do. When the battalion came, then we had to transship to the Novian from our luxurious liner. It was a nasty contrast.
What were conditions like on the Novian then?
Well, as I say, it wasn't much better than a cattle boat, iron decks and everything, and of course very hot at that time. You know. Troops, I think, had a wretched time on it. Officers weren't much, very much better.
Had the men's health suffered at all during the
journey? No, I don't think so.
You were on the island of Mytilene. What did you know of the plans that were in store for your battalion?
Oh, nothing.
You knew nothing?
Nothing, absolutely nothing. Rumour was spread about and encouraged that we were going to land somewhere near Smyrna on the Asiatic coast. Compton Mackenzie was in Italy spreading these rumours. Considerably, I remember seeing him there.
Remember anything about Compton Mackenzie? Did you meet him at all? Do you remember?
I didn't actually meet him, no.
You knew who he was at the time?
No, I knew him by... Well, he was pointed out to me, I better put it that way.
When did you first get your first orders for the landing at Suvla Bay?
Not until we were on the way there.
Ah, so when were you embarked for Suvla Bay?
We embarked on August the 5th. Was it the 5th? Yes. On a small transport which took us to Suvla, which we reached in the early morning, very early morning, August the 6th.
Yeah. So you were told actually en route. Can you remember what you were told about the operation?
Practically nothing at all. I don't think anyone knew anything.
So
from the brigadier downwards, he was just as much in the dark as everybody else. Excessive secrecy marred the Gallipoli all through, I think, from beginning to end.
Did you feel worried at the time that you didn't know what you were meant to
Not
be doing?
Not in the least. Feeling much too perturbed at the prospect, I think.
Was there a lot of worry about the action?
Beforehand, do you mean? Mm. No, I don't think so.
So you were given these minimal instructions.
Nothing at all. We had, I can't remember whether maps were dished out then or even after the landing. All I know is that nobody knew anything.
What did you tell your men that you were doing then? You just
nothing. Couldn't tell them.
So you were on your way to Suvla Bay, although you probably didn't know where you were going. What happened next?
Well, we arrived, as I said, in Suvla Bay in the very early morning, about 4 o'clock, I suppose. And we sat. We were supposed to land, but chaos had already set in. You see, the 11th Division had landed during the previous night. They were put ashore all in the wrong places, or nearly all in the wrong places. Lighters got stuck on rocks which nobody had realised existed, or, well, I won't say they didn't realise, they suspected they had, but hoped they didn't. And our battalion, the Beetle, that's to say the armoured lighter, was supposed to take us off. It ran on the rocks, and so instead of landing in the early morning, we didn't land until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Spent the day having a bird's eye view of what was happening on shore.
Could you describe the scene from the boat that you could see and the
evidence? Yes, you could see troops, a lot of troops huddled behind the sort of mound. It wasn't much bigger than a mound of leather barber. It offered quite a good protection from shelling or anything like that. And then there were you could see odd troops moving through the scrub further inland. And one thing I principally remember was a Turkish battery at the bottom of Kidney Hill, which was spasmodically shelling the troops. And the cruiser Euryalus used to have great fun trying to hit it, but never did hit it. Euryalus would fire, and you'd see a tremendous explosion somewhere near where the battery was, and about a minute later the battery would open up again.
But you could actually see this Turkish battery?
Couldn't see the battery, actually, no, but you could see where it fired from.
What was happening at sea? What about the
sea? There was nothing very much happening at sea, apart from trying to land people in the wrong places.
Was the chaos, as a sort of second lieutenant, was the chaos very obvious to you?
Oh yes, once one knew we weren't being landed with our brigade at all, but landed an entirely different part of the beach. Yes, it was pretty obvious.
So, the order... When did it? What happened when you actually were told to land?
Well, as I say, our beetle had gone on the rocks. It was got off eventually, and we got ashore about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And our orders then were to take over from the 11 Manchesters who had landed on the previous night on the ridge of Kiryat Tepe. And first thing I remember about the landing, which was at Ghazi Baba, right at the extreme point of Suvla Bay, the northern point of Suvla Bay, was my first sight of a dead Turk. Nice looking old gendarme, bearded Turk in the brown uniform that the gendarmes wore. Of course, the gendarmes were a form of militia in a sense. And we had a nice, refreshing thunderstorm, which was very welcome because it was frightfully hot. Everybody got soaked and cooled off nicely with the draught. And then when it came dark, we wended our way up the slopes and took over from the Manchesters, sort of astride the ridge. Now we're stuck.
Can I just ask you about a couple of points in that? Could you, I realise it'd be a brief description, could you describe the Beetle that you actually landed, the landing craft? Can you remember anything about
it? Well, there were small armoured, I don't know what you'd call them quite, small armoured barges, I suppose, armoured barges with a prow which could let down, just like the modern landing ships, keep out shell splinters, I think were bulletproof too, and they held about 500 men crammed in.
So they were quite large?
Oh yes, fair size.
How did you feel as you were approaching the beach? Was it?
I suppose we felt excited, I wouldn't like to say.
And when you actually saw this dead body, what was your actual reaction to it?
Well, I suppose the natural reaction is slight revulsion the first time you see somebody killed in action.
It didn't affect your nerve at all?
No.
So you'd moved inland. As you were going inland, was there any other evidence of chaos when you went up to take over from the
land? No, because, we were moving, you see, after dark up to take over from the Manchesters, and one saw very little except on what was quite close to one. We took up a rough sort of line.
What was the terrain like as you climbed up the Kirich Tepe?
Well, a lot of scrub, the prickly oak scrub, and of course entirely rocky, and as we very soon found when we tried to dig in at all, you really couldn't dig in at all, you had to make sangars.
Was it difficult territory to cross? Did the troops get tired climbing up there? How far inland did you move?
I suppose it was best part of a mile probably.
And you couldn't really see what was happening?
No,
it was
after dark.
What was the line like that you took over from the Manchesters?
Well, it was just a position in the scrub and on the rocks, you might say. They hadn't been able to do, of course, any defence constructions at all. No one was, at that time, we imagined we were going forward, but instead of going to be stuck there for the next fortnight.
So it was basically a sangar. Could you just describe what a sangar is?
Well, a sangar is a breastwork built up of rocks.
But there wasn't actually much dug out behind
it was almost solid rock, you see, once you got down a few inches.
Was the sangha continuous across
the... No, they'd be dotted about.
So obviously you were fairly exposed to shelling behind.
Yes, there was very little Turkish shelling up on the ridge, practically none at the start. The Turks had withdrawn.